Hey there, it's Melissa Brunetti, and welcome to the Mind Your Own Karma podcast.
Hey there, Karma crew. Thanks for joining me for this episode of Mind Your Own Karma, The Adoption Chronicles. I have a special adoptee guest today. You might know Jennifer Diane Gostin from her podcast, Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land. Let me tell you a little bit more about Jennifer. She is a same-race domestic adoptee in reunion with both sides of her biological family. After a 27-year career in law enforcement with the Chicago Police Department, she retired in 2014 as a police detective. In 2015, she self-published her memoir, The Truth So Far, A Detective's Journey to Reunite with Her Birth Family. She credits her spiritual journey that started over 40 years ago for allowing her path to unfold in unexpected and meaningful ways. In 2021, Jennifer's continued efforts to be open, honest, and public about her lived experience while holding space for other members of the Constellation, primarily adoptees, has led to hosting the podcast Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land. She currently co-facilitates the Adoptee Voices writing group created by Sarah Easterly. Here is my interview with Jennifer Diane Gostin. So we are welcoming Jennifer Diane Gostin to the show today. She is a fellow podcaster, and I was a recent guest on her show, and the link for that will be in the show notes, as well as the link to her wonderful adoptee podcast. And there's those people that you meet and you talk to, and you just feel like this special connection. And Jennifer's one of those people for me. Just that positive energy that you can feel from you and just when you speak, and I love it. And so welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor to be here with you, Melissa.
Thank you. So let's just begin with telling us whatever you feel comfortable with sharing about your adoption experience.
Sure. I guess we'll start from 1964, right? I was born in May and relinquished within 4 days. And went into foster care for the next 2 years.
Wow.
And permanently placed through adoption in 66. It was finalized in 67. I always kind of want to make a point of that. So in 66, I'm 2, and I go to live with my new family, the Gostins, but it's not finalized for another year. And I think that was kind of common back then.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just say I was adopted at 2 and would remain there in a very healthy home. I used to say, like on my podcast, I used to ask this question, did you have a happy childhood, right? Mm. And then somewhere I shifted to a better question is healthy. I would say I was happy, but I think healthy covers the fact that I got a good education. I never wanted for anything physical, you know, like I was an only child. So I just had everything that you can imagine parents would want to give a child. And I had parents that really wanted the very best for me. And I would consider that healthy.
Yeah.
So fast forward, I've always known I was adopted. I don't recall not knowing. That's how I would put it. The social worker in my case made it pretty clear to my parents two things. She was named at birth, Bonnie Upshaw. Keep that name. Even though you're introducing Jennifer, she's been answering to Bonnie, like introduce it as a nickname, which I think was excellent advice.
Yeah.
And the second one was talk to her about being an adopted child, age appropriate. Yeah, so I think that has served me very well over the years, right? And so I just remember clearly around the age of 12, letting my adoptive mom know that I wanted to know about my birth mother. Mm. So I come from a closed system, so I better say that, meaning records were all sealed. I was not to know anything about my original family. At the same time, I wondered if my adoptive parents had information, things they could share with me. And I was quickly told, asked, why would you want to do that? Like, why, you know, are you not happy kind of thing? So I closeted the field. And there really weren't any conversations about what I was thinking about, more thinking than feeling, about being adopted. And so I think right around 18, I recall wanting to have this conversation again, and it being something that my adoptive mom just did not want to talk about. She was unable to conceive, and that had a lot to do with me being adopted. And I don't think she ever really dealt with her grief. So fast forward, I get married and we have a son. And so that would be my first biological connection. So again, I'm thinking about how important it is to know more to my beginnings. But I do, I kind of just cage my curiosity for many, many years. I would say it was 8 years. I think it was 8 years after my adoptive mom passed that I said, I need to search. I need to do this for me, for my son. And that's when I would begin the search.
Wow. So how old were you then?
I was 47 or 48. So it was like 2009, 2010 in there.
Yeah. It's funny that adoptees feel like they have to have either an excuse to search, they need a reason to search, or that they wait until their adoptive parents pass. And then it kind of gives them that permission to do that.
Yeah. 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 I think I was very much absorbed in my life, the other like parts of my identity. So as you know, I joined the police department in 87. So that was just prior to getting married. So then you have that family. And then I was promoted to detective in 98. And that's a whole nother animal, because you really are getting the most difficult and challenging cases in a big city like Chicago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. So I want to back up a second. You said that you were in foster care for a couple of years. Do you know why you were in foster care for that long before you were adopted?
So from my understanding, the Chicago Child Care Society handled my adoption. And typically what would happen is from the place of birth, which was the Salvation Army Booth Memorial Hospital, they had some sort of relationship with the Chicago Child Care Society. So whenever a birth occurred, Chicago Child Care would then place that baby in a foster home. And why it took 2 years, I'm going to say just a little bit of information I got. That family, the Smith family, who I have been in reunion with, was seeking to adopt me. Mm-hmm. And I guess kept coming up short, was not qualifying. And I think that played a part in me being there perhaps longer. But I don't necessarily think Black babies were the easiest to place. So mm-hmm. I will say for your audience, I am a same race domestic adoptee. And I think that may have played a part as well.
Yeah. How heartbreaking for your foster family to want to keep you and for some reason not be able to. Ugh, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Just to give a little story, 5 children in that home, so 7 members of the family. So I'm picturing this really active household, right? Yeah, I think it was four boys and one girl. And the youngest was maybe 7 and the oldest was like 17. So yeah, it was a very different family situation than what I would be adopted into, because I was the only child in that home growing up. I think that And I don't know, like, I would really like to investigate this, whether or not at that time social workers or agencies deemed that household with all the children like being enough, like they had enough. And here was another family, a couple who were older. They had they were very established, and they had a home, single family home. And they didn't have any other children, right? No other financial obligations. And they just appeared to be able to maybe give me more. But I'm thinking that give me more sounds more materialistic, right?
But that's maybe probably what they, one of the considerations that they were thinking was they've got all these kids now, you know, maybe they wouldn't be able to take care of another one, although they were for 2 years, but I don't know. I know a lot of us were put in the foster care system. I think it was just part of what they did back then. I don't know if it was, I know in my case, my birth mother was still trying to figure out a way to keep me, but I think maybe it's kind of like a cooling off period to see if she changes her mind or something like that, you know, before they place you somewhere. I'm just guessing. I don't know. I don't know. But you opened your original birth certificate in kind of a unique way. And so I want you to tell us about that. And how did you feel when you saw that document?
Let me start with that second part. Elated. I just remember asking the group, it was about 60 people in the room, what did they want me to announce first from the birth certificate? And they said, your given name. And even now it kind of makes me emotional because that was the first thing I wanted to see. And for me, it confirmed, I think it just confirmed that, oh, that part of my story is true. You know, because I had been told Bonnie was my given name. So I thought, okay, that feels good to know that, yeah, that's truthful. And the second thing I wanted to see was my birth mother's name, her signature. It felt like I was connected even more just seeing that. But the overall document, just having having something that was produced or created at the very beginning. Yeah, like that's pretty important because as we know as adoptees, the amended birth certificate feels so off. You know, it just feels like, nah, that's not quite what happened. The other part of your question is I made a decision sometime in 2010 or 2011, when I had the opportunity to meet the filmmaker Gene Stross, to be public and open and honest with the telling of a part of my story. And I love parties. Let me say that first. I love a great party. And I remember talking with Gene, and I said, you know, why don't I have a celebration for the new law? And because she wanted to film, she had been filming me, you know, on and off during this process.
So the new
And
law was that they were opening up your state to allow you
yes.
to get, okay.
Yes, Illinois changed its adoption law to allow us to request our original birth certificates in 2011, which I did. And so this is like the end of 2011. So as we're approaching 2012, I'm sorry, 20, yeah, 2012, I remember this conversation with Jean and a few other people from the community that I thought a celebration was in order to invite adoptees and really all members of the constellation to come together and also family and friends. I felt that a lot of people that are not adopted or shall we say a birth parent or an adoptive parent, they don't have a clue about what we go through as adoptees. And so a lot of people in the room were people that were learning, like learning what's going on with this original birth certificate and why is it so meaningful to her. And yeah, so the party, It was something that I'm so glad I did, because people left there feeling just inspired about change and how it does happen, as slow as it may take, and that it is so important for adoptees to be seen and heard. Yes.
Do you know how changing that law in the state made adoptive parents and birth parents feel? Did you hear anything from that community?
That's a great question. I don't recall adoptive parents coming to me per se. I will share this though. And this was after the party, maybe 2017, 15 or 16, having a conversation third party about an adoptive parent who had a teenage adoptee in the home, along with two biological children a year or so younger than that adoptee. And she feeling that she had no need to tell the adoptee she was adopted, and not quite understanding what is important to an adult adoptee about our records. And yes, I do remember that. And that was so heartbreaking to me all these years later.
What do you feel about the right to privacy for adoptive parents and birth parents, versus the right for adoptees to know? What are your feelings?
I don't know if I have an answer for you yet, like right now. I have heard this question in the community quite a bit, and I guess I'm biased. Yeah, I'm somewhat biased. I understand birth parents, some of them, but then you know what? I've heard too many birth parents say, adoptees need to know everything. Tell them everything. And I'm like, yay, you know, like, absolutely. So there are quite a few birth parents that don't agree with this whole right to privacy. Like, they totally embrace centering the adoptee.
I just feel like we get our rights signed away before we can even have a say in that. And that's where I get hung up. It's like, wait a second. Where were my rights back then? Or where are they now that I'm an adult? We still don't have, the right to know. So, especially health records and that kind of thing. That for everybody else, it's super important. I mean, that's one of the first things the doctor will ask you is, what's your medical history? And for some reason, it just doesn't matter if you're an adoptee, and it doesn't matter anymore. That you don't know. It's just like crazy. So after you opened your birth certificate, I assume your mother's name was on there. Was it her correct name? Because I've always heard like people signing different names, and sometimes the birth father's not on the certificate. So what was on yours? Was it the correct birth parent's name?
It was her correct name, yes. And my birth father's name was not on there. It said unknown. And I remember, because that by this time I had some information about him. I was able to find my birth mother's best friends as teenagers. And you tell your girlfriends some of everything that you don't even tell other people. So I learned a lot about him through them, that he was her boyfriend. And clearly he was not unknown. And I just thought, And it was Lorraine Dusky, a birth mom who's been a guest on my show, who put words to what it feels like for an adoptee to see unknown when that's not true. And that shouldn't be, unknown should not be put on that document if that's not true.
Yeah. I mean, it blows my mind that this legal document that we use to say who we are for everything can be falsified or was even encouraged to be falsified back then, for unwed mothers and, to be anonymous, basically. So they were encouraged to like write a whole different name on a legal document and then to leave off the father, and for the father to not even have to sign away their parental rights. They had none back then. They really didn't have any. Just blows my mind. So you found your mom's name. Did you find her, your birth mother? What happened there?
So yeah, I work with the search angel, Melissa Mitchell. I always like to mention her name because she just was a wonderful searcher for me and just with me during that whole process. So once I gave her my birth mother's name, she located her really within hours and learned she had passed. She was at peace for 16 years when I learned of her identity. So, in a sense, I feel like I found her. Yeah, like I know when I was able to get a stone for her grave, I put that on there. I found you. So, in a sense, I feel like I found her, even though I wasn't able to reunite with her.
Did you feel like your adoptive mom kind of, because if back then when you were asking about it, maybe if she would have been a little more open to, giving you some information or at least being a little bit encouraging, then your birth mother would have been alive to be able to meet her. Did you feel any resentment there?
That my adoptive mom would have been resentful.
Yeah, or, because she wasn't very open when you brought it up to her about searching. And so that kind of made you, as a lot of adoptees shut that door for a while. Did you feel any
Yes.
resentment for that?
No, I really don't. It's interesting you'd ask me that because I know I was kind of revisiting, like, what would my adoptive mom be like, right? 2011, 2012, had she been alive. And I think that she would have been far more open than she was decades earlier. And I think one of the reasons is because as I brought my son along with me, so he was like about 20 years old, and we would talk about everything that I was learning, when I was attending the conferences and reading memoirs and just meeting so many people who were in reunion and what it meant for them, sharing it with him, he slowly but surely got it, right? And he and my mother were so close. So I kind of envision him helping her. And I think with the passage of time, we start to get a better understanding, of what is important, my health, history, his health history. I think she would have been far more open. And while it may have been difficult at times, because I listen to adoptees say that they saw how their adoptive parent kind of struggled here and there, or, it was kind of up and down. I think it would have been a lot better for her than it was to think about this in the past.
Yeah. So were you able to meet any relatives on either side? And what was that reunion experience like, for you?
It was wonderful. And let's just start with the maternal side, right? So, very distinctly different reunions. And I would say a lot of it had to do with the fact that my maternal side knew about me. So my birth mother had told my brother when he was young, and she told my aunt, and extended family members knew that I existed, when I was born, all of that. So fast forward to 2012, and I have a name and an address, and I go to this building, and I meet the first person on my birth mother's side, and that's my aunt. And oh my goodness, it was, first of all, she married, so she's not biologically related to me. She married my birth mother's youngest brother.
Okay.
And I gotta tell you, even still, meeting her and her knowing the story, which is a big piece there, when she saw me and I just told her who I was and who I was looking for, because I didn't know who she was, she put her hands to her face and said, "Oh my God, I see it. I see the upshot all
Wow.
in you." And in that moment, of course, I'm validated. I don't have to really, like, I don't have to explain. Nobody's like suspicious of what I'm doing there. They
Right.
completely understand because my birth mother had said she's going to come here because she had the same name.
Oh, okay.
Name that I had as an infant. So yeah, that was deeply meaningful. And then she just started making phone calls, got in touch with a younger sibling, my brother, 22 months younger, and she had a son, so that's my first cousin, and I definitely saw the mirroring with him. And yeah, it just kind of all unfolded quite quickly, because it would be that same evening I would meet my brother in person. And yeah, that was great. And I tell you, I just think it's so important for people. And I'm thinking of a birth mom right now. I'm thinking of Leslie Pate McKinnon, who told her children when they were little, her twins, that she had two sons that she relinquished. She told them when they were little people, like third grade or before, I think kindergarten. And so they grow up knowing, and it's not a secret.
Yeah.
And that's what I felt in reunion with my maternal side. I was not a secret, and I'm thankful for that.
Yeah. And what about the paternal side? So your father wasn't on the birth certificate. So did you do DNA or how did you?
I did. So 2017, I waited 5 years because I was like just kind of taking it in, right?
Digesting.
That's the word, digesting this whole idea that I finally found a part of my biological tree. So 2017, I do a DNA test in May. And may I share this quick story about it? So I do it, and I got the kit that I held on to for months before I did it. So May, I do it. In June, I get an email like, "Yeah, see, we're related." And it is my birth father's first cousin. But here's the thing, his wife was really the one working ancestry and trying to build a tree and all of that. He really would never have submitted his DNA if it hadn't been for her.
Wow.
And he didn't submit his DNA until the early part of 2017. So even if I had, I would have been waiting, right?
Yeah. Wow. Wow. So how was he? Because he didn't know you existed, correct?
Oh,
Like,
yeah. So that brings me to how different reunions can be. And certainly that was my case. And I would describe it as everybody was kind to me. So I respond to the email seeing the match and saying, "Yes, my father is William Gilmore." And he immediately knew. And I had a little bit of information to kind of suggest that maybe I did know him and maybe I was related to him. And so it was well received, and I was invited over, and everybody's still in Chicago. And I just remember them pulling out pictures, books of pictures for me. Now, that's something that I was unable to get on my maternal side. That was wonderful to get on my paternal. However, I think when you're not known about, this was the first time they had heard of this news. There is some kind of, I don't know, hesitancy maybe, or like I remember getting, so tell me again, like the story, like tell me again who you are, and yeah, and you know that can be kind of taxing for an adoptee, to keep having to. I felt reassure everyone that I was who I said I was, you know. And then we get back to, yeah, well, we know DNA doesn't lie, but a lot of times people do kind of still like, I don't know, I need to know a little more information, you know, or I need to, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure it could be kind of shocking. And then they're trying to deal with, their stuff. So, what advice would you give someone, an adoptee that's getting ready to search? What do you think they should, some things they maybe they should think about before?
Yes, I first and foremost, I would say get acquainted with the adoption community first and foremost. I think the most helpful thing for me was to read memoirs and be with adoptees that had been through a reunion, that had that had you know, just a little bit of experience with how it went for them, you know, and because as you know, stories are so different. Some people stayed at the house, some people with the birth parents, some people went by themselves to meet, and some took, like, it's so many stories, and just get a feel for, through other people's lived experience, how it played out and how it may play out in your situation, and whatever resonates with you, lean into that.
Yeah, that's good. I feel like if you listen to other people's stories, then you kind of think, well, what if that happened to me? How would I react? Just getting to know the possibilities of what might happen will get you to think, oh, that could, what if that happens to me?
Exactly. And one thing I'll say, I read a lot about birth parents being deceased. I clearly recall reading a lot of that, like, don't be surprised if you find a grave. And that was, knowing that, upon that being my reality, it went a long way. It went a long way just having heard that before. And how you can still focus on everybody else. Because in my reunion, one of the most precious things to me, particularly on my maternal side, is my brother has kids. And those are my great, I mean, those are my nieces and nephews, and they have kids, and those are my great nieces and nephews. And I see that generation being around a long time that I get to be a part of. So it became pretty quickly bigger than my birth parents.
Yeah, well, it kind of had to because, your birth mother was passed. And so on your paternal side, did you have siblings there on the paternal side?
I, not that I know of, but it's rumored that my birth father had maybe two or three children, but I haven't been able
Not
to get.
confirmed, yeah.
Been able to get any information. Just still hopeful. I hope DNA will pop.
Yeah. It's funny because I think I have a few first cousins. Those are like my closest relatives on in DNA, And nobody's contacted me. Like, nobody's been like, I don't know her. Like, that's my cousin and I don't know her. Maybe they do. Maybe they knew about me. I don't think so though. It's just weird that nobody's really questioned it and I've not heard from anyone. It just kind of confirms that feeling in me, like that I was never really born, that the stork brought me and I never had, I was never born like a normal person. Like I just I was just here one day. I just appeared. Just kind of confirms that for me. But
a lot of it happens still yet, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have a podcast, and it's adoption focused. And besides being an adoptee, what led you to do an adoptee focused podcast? What was your why in creating Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land?
Yeah. Well, 2020, as we all know, created a lot of shifts. And that's when I started to think about, I guess, midway and towards the end of 2020, I started to think about a podcast to do an audio drama because I wanted to finish telling the rest of my story. And so, yeah, I was able to do that, launch it in March of 2021. And I quickly learned, like, I want to say, when I was preparing for episode 4 and 5, I realized that adoptees wanted to share their stories. Like, I knew that they were doing that. You know, I had been listening to podcasts, Adoptees On with Haley Radke, and of course, Damon Davis is Who Am I Really? So I knew that, like, yeah, that's a pretty big deal. And adoptees are interested in that. What I didn't realize is that they wanted to talk to me about it, you know, and be on my podcast. And yeah, it just kind of took off. And as you probably know, I don't think it could be enough podcasts featuring adoptees and centering adoptees, because there are so many of us, and we do want to be seen and heard.
Yeah. Yeah. We need to educate. There's so much education that needs to happen. Yeah. That's what keeps me going, really. When did you realize the resource in your podcast that it was that, because even though we do a lot of adoptee focused stuff, there's the whole constellation, I think, too, that needs to be included. So when did you realize that your podcast was a valuable resource to them as well?
In 2021, I would receive a lot, well, maybe not a lot, but I'd receive enough emails from adoptees who were interested in being a guest. And they gave me feedback. I remember hearing that they were listening to like every episode, which I thought was pretty interesting. Like, yeah, but to feel less alone, that's why they were really tuning in. And then by year 2 and 3, several adoptees and other members of the Constellation said that sharing their story publicly was a healing experience. So that was like pretty important too. And I'd like to share, yeah, a particular story that happened in 2020, I guess 2023. Yeah, the early part. I was in attendance at the Untangling Our Roots Summit in 2023, sitting at the table with a woman who I had never met before. And after introducing ourselves and getting to know each other, she said she listened to my podcast. So this conversation was like, to my total pleasant surprise. And she proceeded to refer to an episode with Brian Stanton. And he and I had had a lengthy, fun, and informative conversation about the upcoming event in Louisville. And we discussed how beneficial conferences over the years had been for both of us. So this lovely lady at the table told me that after listening to Brian, she decided to attend the summit at the last minute. And it was like in that moment that I added like more to my why of doing Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land. And it was because how far reaching of a resource it can be for our community. I believe it inspires people to pick up a book, like a memoir, and attend online or in-person events, and to just get curious about what's like the next step in their life's journey. Yeah. So that I think that sums up my answer.
Yeah, I think you, like me, feel like we need to hear each other's stories. It's so important to get that whole picture, and for me, it's super healing. I don't know how you feel about it, but listening to birth mother stories is has helped me release a lot that I was holding on to with my birth mother and things like that. Just kind of getting that compassion and understanding through other people's stories and listening.
Same here, very healing. Yeah, and I've said many times, I do think, and I got this from another adoptee, that storytelling is healing for the listener and the storyteller.
And you, a lot of adoptees, including you, find like writing and journaling very healing. And you're part of the Adoptee Voices writing group created by Sarah Easterly. What's been meaningful about being a part of that group for you?
Well, listening to other adoptees like read their words aloud, so like the last 3 years, it's just exceeded my every expectation. I know in the early days with the cohort, we came together online like for once a week for 8 weeks, and now we meet for like 6 weeks to devote time to write. And adoptees share aloud parts of their adoption story. And I'm talking about immense talent from everyone. Some people who don't even consider themselves writer, like we get tickled when people say, I'm not a writer, not a writer, but this is what I came up with. And I mean, they blow it up. It's just beautiful. And so it's this positive exchange of feedback. I love the feedback. I'm always like, wow, yeah. Like whenever somebody can put words to my feelings and thoughts, I'm just taken aback. Because a lot of times, and that's why I think it's so important for adoptees to write, because a lot of times an adoptee can be feeling something but not have the words for what they're feeling. And so many times adoptees have been able to, in the writing group, to do that, to give another writer in the room. And when they go on to publish, someone reading their words saying, yeah, that's what I've been feeling and that's what I've been thinking. And thank you for giving me the word. So that has been so meaningful for me to be a part of that group. And I think what Sarah Easterly has created, we're going into our fourth year now, is something that was so needed. And there are other writing groups, but I love how she has developed two tracks. So I co-facilitate the Honor Your Voice track with Kate Murphy, and Sarah and Alice Stevens facilitate the Hone Your Craft track. Especially for writers, you could join either track. I mean, it doesn't matter where you are, but Hone Your Craft is specifically designed for that writer who is looking to publish, because I don't think a lot of writers are necessarily looking to publish. So that's the distinguishing feature. But yeah, it's great. And for more information, you can go to adoptees-voices.com.
Okay, we'll put that in the show notes as well. I'm just kind of curious, after talking and interviewing so many adoptees, what areas do you see that's kind of a common part of where we struggle?
What's coming up for me right now is another adoptee that I have actually recorded with twice. So he's been on my podcast and he will be back on. And we were having a conversation about processing things. So the short version of our conversation, or him sharing with me, was that once he learned that he was not adopted till he was, I think, 2 months old, he, upon hearing that, he wondered, you know, like, well, where was I?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big one. I've heard it many times. Where was I? And as the months went by and the years went by, because I think he's in reunion, maybe coming up on 4 years, he wrestled with that. Like, that would come up because he is unable to get information about that. And as a grandfather holding his grandchildren upon birth and as little, really little people, he's now wondering, well, when did I get that? And or I didn't get that, or like, yeah, he doesn't have the answers. Mm-hmm. And it's very painful. Right. And so I think a lot of times we as adoptees, we start to unpack things, look at them a little closer, because there are these things that happen now in our lives that activate it. And to use myself, I remember when one of my grandsons was 2 years old and we spent the weekend together. We had such a wonderful time. And when his mother came to pick him up, he ran to her because he knows that's his mother. And that, you know, I love you, Grandma, but I'm going to go home with Mom. And I got it. Like, I get it. And I was once that two-year-old. And I remember that. That activated or triggered something in me. And two-year-olds do that for me. So back to your question. I think the struggle is because there are things that we maybe don't like, or that sadden us about what happened, or things we don't know, these missing pieces, and the things in our life, the experiences now, today, take us back there. Yeah, it just keeps taking us back there. And I know we're going to get to what guidance I have, I'm sure, in a little bit of what works for me, because it happens to me too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, I think, where I feel like I wasn't born, is that gap where I was in foster care from, you know, now that I've met my birth mother and I've heard my birth story, but there was still that gap where, and I have no idea who was nurturing me and taking care of me and holding me. And I think that's where I feel like I was not born, was because of that gap. As you were talking, I was like, that's it. That's why I feel that. Cause I just, that's a missing piece that I'll probably never be able to figure out or find, you know?
Sure.
So you wrote a memoir. Tell us about that, and tell us about what's been rewarding about being on the other side of writing and publishing your book.
Well, one thing that stands out above anything is it was so cathartic. It was healing to unpack like some of my truth so far, and to kind of just really look at it like on the page. So that's first and foremost. And I know that writing it connected me to the community in a more meaningful way. And certainly publication gave me more courage and confidence to be like on the field instead of in the bleachers, you know, with the subject of relinquishment, or talking about the subject of relinquishment and adoption. And there's nothing wrong with sitting on the sidelines or in the stands. And I'm often there too, when I'm listening to other adoptees and, you know, podcasts and being in support groups and conferences and workshops, or just learning something new. However, I just find it important for me to actively participate when given the opportunity. And the reason why is because I know how valuable it has been for me when others have been open, honest, and public about their journey. So that's it in a nutshell. And yeah, it has just it's meant a lot to have it out there so that people can reach out to me and feel, I would say it's just more connection.
When was it published?
2015.
So you were probably one of the first pioneers of writing about your adoption experience.
Not at all. Then,
no, is there a bunch?
Oh,
wow.
My goodness. Yeah, not at all. I think that, and I thought that too. I remember thinking that too. I read a fair number of memoirs back in 2010, 2011, when I would go to conferences and learn about adoptee authors. But I had no idea that many adoptees had already shared, you know, their story in book form.
Wow. Didn't know that. So anything else? I know the writing and journaling has helped you. Any other number to your healing combination besides those things?
I think it's always going to be just a combination of things. And by that, I mean, I love being out in nature. I was just listening to a podcast this morning about how nature is one of the best tools for healing, and I guess understanding like how we fit into things and how we can be supported through nature to heal and to thrive and to persevere, you name it. Like, I would say nature is one of my biggest supporters in feeling wellness. Truly it is. And I'm a dog person, and I have a dog. She's been with me 10 years almost, and our relationship is amazing. She's the best listener in the world. She's my therapist every day. And I think animals do that. That's the point I want to make, that animals, I don't think they judge us. They support us in our healing as well. So they're just a list of things, but certainly writing, learning more about other people's stories is healing for me. I tell you, I never thought it would be as healing as it's been in these years working on the podcast.
Yeah.
I've had some extraordinary conversations with adoptees that have really found their tools and are sharing them with everybody else by being public with their story.
Yeah, I think it changes too, you know, what worked for you yesterday might be something different today as you peel back those, you know, every onion layer. It could change, you know.
That's a good point, which speaks to what you're doing, right? As a certified somatic imagery.
Yeah.
That's a perfect example.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I've been on my healing journey pretty kind of steadily on that journey for about 15 years. And this would have been something that I would have thought was too woo-woo. And, you know, I'm an ultrasound tech. I'm like scientific and, you know, what are you talking about? The subconscious stuff and it getting stored. And, you know, I would have thought, no. And now it's just like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is it, you know, but in 10 years from now, it might be something else. You just don't know. Just keep on figuring out what works for you. And that's why I like to ask people that question, because everybody's different. Everybody's different and it changes. So kind of in closing, what would you like struggling adoptees to know?
I love this question that you asked your guests. And I would say investigate the many resources available. And we've talked about them. I've mentioned them, like reading memoirs and joining writing groups and retreats and conferences and listening to podcasts and certainly getting thoughts out of your head through the form of journaling. investigate. That's the word I'm going to say. Investigate all of these. And most importantly, excuse me, I wouldn't underestimate the power of one-on-one relationships with another adoptee. Can I tell you another story?
Yes, yes.
This is to do with the one-on-one. So on at least two occasions, like years ago, I was approached by adult adoptees seeking information and fellowship because they hadn't ever talked openly with another adoptee about their adoption. And I may add that they found me through my book. And that's another reason I'm so glad I put it out there. And I'm still in close relationship with both of these adoptees today.
Wow.
And one went on with my guidance to join a support group with Adoption Network Cleveland. And she joined NAP, National Association of Adoptees and Parents, and more groups, other groups. And then what really warms my heart is she ultimately helped form a support group for Black female adoptees. So the other adoptee preferred to engage with other adoptees one-on-one. But both of these women explored the valuable resources and chose what worked best for them. And I highly encourage any and everyone to not isolate. Most importantly, don't choose isolation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so important. Getting that validation, then actually having somebody listen that's been there, and you don't feel like you're being judged. Or, you know, a lot of times I feel like they're like, you have great parents. Like, why are you even talking about this? Why is this an issue? Like, it can just be like, you know, take one parent and replace it with another parent and everything's fine, right? It's like, there's just so much more to it. And you don't feel like getting into all those intricacies, but when you're talking to another adoptee, that's, you know, that's huge because you can, and they understand. So, yeah. So tell us, where can we find your book and your podcast and anything else that you're involved in?
Well, I just send people to jenniferdianegostin.com. I think less is more. I'm not real big on social media right now. I am on Facebook occasionally. But yeah, I would say just go to my website and you can find everything there, the podcasts. And certainly I encourage your listeners that if they are interested in reaching me, that's the best way, through the website.
Perfect. Well, I just want to thank you for all you do for the adoptee community and for me personally. So happy to have met you and consider you a friend now, as well as a colleague. So just thank you for being who you are and what you do. And your podcast is awesome. Check it out, people. The links will be in the show notes. But so I just want to thank you for coming on today and sharing your story.
Well, thank you, Melissa, for having me. I too agree that our paths cross for such purpose and meaning. And I love what you're doing. And I'm glad you were a guest on my podcast. And I know we've talked already about the suffering piece, but I just think that's such an important question to ask your guests. And I wanted just to add one thing that,
sure,
you know, everyone should just remain open to, you know, like all the possibilities to not suffer. And I do believe suffering is optional. Someone many times has been quoted saying, any suffering related like to my adoption story has always been connected to the narrative I tell myself and others. And I love when you say, be prepared for magic. That resonates with me. And I'll add to that, we can turn our pain into purpose in life. And it becomes then a gift.
Yeah. I'm so glad that Jennifer ended on that note of kind of just being curious about what works for you, what feels good to you, what is part of your healing combination, to just keep searching for it because there is so many resources out there. So please don't give up. And if you are having trouble finding a therapist or any number to your combination, please get in touch with me. I have a whole list of adoptee practitioners, others that work with birth parents and adoptive parents. If you're somebody that's listening today that is also seeking help, email me, mindyourowncharma@gmail.com, and let me know. I can send you the link to that list. I am also a somatic mindful guided imagery practitioner and would love to work with you as well. So you can go to somatichealingjourneys.com if you would like to know more about me and that practice. As always, take what you need and leave what you don't. And always remember to mind your own karma. I will see you next time.